The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
And so let's turn to a report today that was brought out by the Irish Music Rights Organisation. We're joined by its chairperson, Eleanor McAvoy. And Eleanor, just first of all, tell people what the Irish Music Rights Organisation is, who it represents.
Sure. So Irish Music Rights Organisation, we collect, basically the simplified version is we collect royalties where music is played, whenever and wherever music is played, and we pay it out to the people who own those royalties, so the writers and the publishers.
There's not an awful lot of that money to go around these days, is there?
Well, I mean, there is. There's more, you know, we're doing well. I guess the problem is making sure that the money goes to the right people and that, for example, when things are streamed, that it's transparent. Like, where is the money going? Is it going to the multinational tech platforms? Is it going to the writers? Is it going to, who's it going to? So, that's really what.
And who is it going to? Because the perception is at this stage that the streaming services are paying a pittance to the performers whose work they're profiting from.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue for sure. The amount per stream is ridiculously small. I would say that it's increasing all the time. It is getting better.
Off a very, very low base.
From a very low base, absolutely. It's important that it increases. I think it's important that they're transparent as well, so you can actually see, well, where is the money going? but it has increased hugely over the last while. The Copyright Directive was a great help, the one that came in from Europe, that forced to level the playing field a little bit so that the likes of YouTube, etc., had to start paying, and were paying licences first. So it is getting better all the time. We have a long way to go. But now we have the new threat of AI. So I suppose that's, you know, where we were looking for extra bit of support today. I mean,
OK, tell me what you perceive the threat from artificial intelligence to be.
OK, so I suppose what we're talking about is generative AI. Basically, people scraping our works and then the AI companies putting them out, not paying anything for the use of our works. That's basically it, not respecting our intellectual property.
I can imagine, for example, a scraping of all the traditional Irish music that might be available and then AI generating new music, which nobody would have to be paid for, and it been played and people not having any idea that it actually isn't original.
Yeah, and it's a double whammy because not only are they stealing your works, but they're then diluting the content on the platforms like the Spotify's or the Deezer's or whatever. A huge amount of the works that are uploaded to them now are, you know, AI generated. So we've a lot of threats out there, but I want to kind of be positive about this, Matt, to be honest.
Because give me ideas okay. As to how you can deal with the threat of generative AI.
First thing and foremost you can do is you can implement the AI Act from Europe. If we implement that here and we don't dilute it, so we keep it really true to the Act, that's going to go a long way towards protecting us. Respecting copyright law as it is, that's going to go a long way towards protecting us. You know, like people, when you're talking about intellectual property, people often don't get it. It's a property right regulated by statute, gives the right to you to prevent or to stop the use of work, to permit or prevent the use of works by others. So, you know, you can't touch it, you can't feel it because it's a song. But it's as if you had a car. It's as if you had a building and somebody's trying to steal that car from you. And I think a lot of the problem is some of the big AI companies are coming in and saying, oh, but you're standing in the way of innovation if you don't let us steal your car. You know, like, and they say, but if we pay for things, it'll have to slow us down. But you know what, Matt, when I go to, you know, supermarket on the way home to get my stuff for dinner, you know, it slows me down having to go to the checkout and pay for it. It doesn't mean that I can walk out of there with the groceries. You know, so yes, it is going to slow them down a little bit, but it's very doable.
Has the European Union brought in an AI Act?
Yes.
Or is it considering, because there's been a lot of talk about, with the Trump trade wars in particular, that Europe might be reluctant to implement certain things that America is against, and America is very much looking after its own tech companies.
Yes, you're spot on. Well, the European Parliament has brought out an AI Act. I guess the issue now is that there's guidelines around it and it hasn't been implemented, and that's where the issue is. I mean, to be honest, when the AI Act came out first, everybody was applauding Europe and looking to Europe going, my God, Europe is leading the way here. You know, but
the implementation is threatened by the inclusion in the trade war negotiations.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's short-sighted in a way because when DeepSeek stole the intellectual property of the AI companies, there was blue murder. They were screaming, but they've stolen our intellectual property. And you're thinking, we're through the looking glass here. I mean, this is Alice in Wonderland stuff, you know. So copyright exists to protect everybody. And if you adhere to copyright, it will protect you.
But would you be confident that the Irish government will look to implement these various AI Act, given that we are so dependent on many of these companies, your Metas and your Googles and others, for our tax revenues here in Ireland, and that there's a reluctance at times to do anything which would get us in bad odour with our corporate taxpayers?
Yeah, really, really good point that you're making. I would say that, Alan Kelly and the chairperson of the Joint Oireachtas Committee for Arts, Media, Communications, Culture and Sport in the House that Jack built was very positive about this morning. He's invited us in September. And to be fair to our government, they have been good before about implementing the copyright directive that came in 2018, was it 2017? You know, made law, I think, 2019 here in Ireland. But, you know, they have been good about that. I mean, if you look at it this way, Matt, you know, we're contributing 1 billion to the Irish economy. 1 billion, and we have 13,500 jobs. If you were a big company coming in from outside and you said, you know what, Irish government, we're going to contribute. We're starting this big company. We're going to contribute 1 billion to your economy. We're going to employ 13,500 people. Of course, everybody in Ireland would be falling over trying to accommodate them. But that's what we are. That's the kind of industry we are. And by the way, like other companies that might come in from other countries could go away like that. Our guys aren't going anywhere.
So what sort of supports do you get at present from government?
Well, it depends on the sector, really. I mean, one thing that we do get is the tax exemption for on your writing royalties. I mean, I always like to emphasise this. People say, oh, you don't pay any tax. And I assure you, my four revenue streams, I pay tax on three of them. One of them up to a value of, 50,000, which very, very, very few people would get to that on that particular royalty. You know, and you pay VAT, so those by the way, 23%, and you pay your universal social charge and all that.
That's your publishing royalties, effectively.
Yeah, your publishing royalties. Your income from that is tax exempt up to 50,000 a year. But again, it would rarely be 50,000 a year from anybody. But if you're earning a grand or two on that, and that makes a big difference. And like, cherishing the creator is very vitally important.
Eleanor, I bet you there's people listening who say, oh, she's got four revenue streams, but they may not necessarily be particularly large revenue streams.
When people hear the word royalties, they go, royalties? God, they've got royalties.
You're making a fortune.
Yeah, your royalty could be 0.00001,
Yeah.
That's what royalties are. So I'm glad you said that. There's a misunderstanding of what's involved, I think, in the music business and how much money you make or don't make in the music.
Because you mentioned 13,500 people employed in the sector, but many of those are part-time, aren't they? Is it there at part-time on top of that number? Point I'm making really is that I think we all know various people who are involved in, want to be full-time professional musicians involved in the music industry, who maybe do it on a part-time basis. They may be gigging at weekends or whatever because they can't make a living out of it. So they're doing things like teaching, or they might be working in a local shop or an accountant or whatever. They're doing those things essentially to put bread on the table. And then what they're doing at the weekends is maybe for the love of music, but they can't actually make a living out of it.
Yeah, you're spot on. And the figures are there in the report. I haven't told you this, pages and pages of it. I can't find the exact figures now. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Most people are supplementing their incomes with, teaching jobs or jobs in kind of high, tech or in other industries that kind of pay well, that can afford them the luxury of working then in the music business.
But what about the basic income supports that were put in place by the last government, by then Arts Minister Catherine Martin? How have they been working out for people?
Exceptionally well. But that programme is coming to an end and we don't know what's happening with it. We're hoping that it will be extended and brought out, further. Like, again, the danger here is that people think, oh, it's handouts, it's handouts. It really isn't handouts.
Well, it's cultural investment, isn't it?
It's cultural investment, but it's commercial investment as well, Matt. It's not just cultural. And if I could get that point across to people, does Deloitte have figures about every euro that's invested in the music industry brings in between 4.10, I think 4 euro, 10 back, and 7 euro 70, something like that. It comes out at 5 euro 75 if you even it out. So for every euro you put in, you get 5.75 back. That is a ridiculously strong investment. So, yes, there's a cultural element to it too, and a mental health benefit and community benefit and soft power for Ireland on the world stage, all of that sort of stuff. But there's commercial, really solid commercial results to this too.
In fact, one of the things that the report emphasises as well is just how much money people spend on music or music-related activities in the year. So it could be purchasing your streaming service. It could be going to gigs. It could be, well, there's all sorts of things. How much is it estimated that Irish people spend a year on music?
Oh, 700 and something on festivals, you know, 126 a year or something on the...
streaming services.
Streaming services, sorry, 195 I think is streaming services. So, you know, I mean, the figures are all in the report, but, you know, not only are they spending it, but they're happy to spend it. You know, and
but they're not all happy, but the prices they're charged at times, though, are they? Because I think there is a feeling that, for example, you know, going to a lot of gigs has become too expensive for many people. And then something else that's also highlighted is how difficult it can be to get accommodation if you want to stay somewhere, get affordable accommodation rather than actually having to park your car somewhere, go to a gig and drive home and maybe get home 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, absolutely. When I said they were happy to pay, I was talking about the streaming services. Most of them said they were happy. But you're right. Yeah, the ticket costs can be an issue for people. And like I would say to them, usually the ticket costs, it's about the huge big gigs. You know, the smaller gigs, the ticket costs are usually very, very low. You can see small local acts, you know, and I encourage people to please see small local acts. If you want to support musicians, go to the gigs, buy the merchandise. That is, that goes straight into the artist's pocket. So, yeah, but accommodation is a big issue.
But is there a lack of planning at times in relation to all the concerts? I know that it makes sense that if you're putting on a big stage somewhere, be it Marley Park or Malahide or the RDS or wherever it might be, and I'm just taking the Dublin examples, or the Marquee in Cork, that you want to leave the staging there for a week or two and get as many gigs in as possible. But if there's something happening in Marley Park and something happening in Malahide and something happens somewhere else, then suddenly, where is everybody going to stay? How can there be enough accommodation for all of the people? I mean, is there good planning on the part of the promoters?
Well, you'd have to ask the promoters. I mean, I think in general, we need a bit more joined up thinking. I think we need a national music strategy where we look at it really forensically and say, right, how can we advance the industry? We should do what the Koreans did. You know, the late 90s, after the Asian crash, the Koreans, South Koreans, oh my God.
What did they do?
They created a whole industry. They looked and said, right, we have the potential to build this up into a huge industry. And they put serious money into, kind of support, systemic support, everything from talent agencies and development of music infrastructure. And they created the Korean Wave. They then took their artists and their music and they disseminated it through their diplomatic missions, their embassies. Every time they had a culture, you know, an event and a summit or an industrial thing, they put artists on at those summits, and they created K-pop, and it is one of the biggest. The figures from 2023 from Korea on exports alone, cultural exports, just for 2023, it was $12 billion.
Have we not done historically?
$10.5 billion. Sorry,
but have we not done historically quite well like that? I can think of things like the Chieftains, for example, in China, or Riverdance in China. Okay. Riverdance has gone around the world for us, hasn't it?
I'm glad you brought up Riverdance, okay? Because can I tell you, I was talking to Bill Whelan a while ago, and he said he couldn't write Riverdance now. If he was starting out now, the infrastructure is not there for him to write Riverdance. And even at that, even with the safety nets he had, which is kind of doing bits of work in RTE and been able to kind of pull somebody into a room to RTE to rehearse and, you know, all of that sort of infrastructure that was there that is really not there now. When he finally wrote Riverdance, he could not get the actual piece of music recorded. And he went to record companies, they all turned him down. Now, in fairness to them, a 7-piece music, you know, with no vocals on it, an instrumental piece of music for which you needed an orchestra to record it, it was going to cost a fortune. Nobody'd record it. So he called up his insurance company, a guy in Church and General Insurance that he knew, and said, listen, I can't get anybody to pay for this. Would you guys pay for it? Now, the guy apparently rolled his eyes to heaven and said, okay, Bill, we'll pay for it. Paid for it. But think about that. Without that having been recorded, the whole euphoria and momentum after the Interval Act in Riverdance would have been lost. But as it was, because of Bill's, never mind his creativity, his ingenuity and his persistence, he had that recorded. So he was able to hand it out to, or his record company was able to hand it out to all the DJs in, you know, in this country and get it abroad so that all across Europe they were playing this straight away. Everybody was talking about it. And on that momentum was built Riverdance's show and the whole juggernaut. That
and Moya Doherty and John McColgan and all the work they did in relation to that. Although, again, part of that was maybe entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, I know they made significant investments.
In their houses. You know, literally that kind of...
Well, that brings me to a final point. Do we have enough cultural philanthropy in this country? So bear me out, you know, rather than always expecting the state to do everything, and yes, the state should do something, can we get more? Perhaps there are very wealthy individuals in this country who could perhaps do more, as would have been very prominent in previous generations, that they are sponsors of the arts, to actually put more money into supporting the Irish music industry.
Really good point. I mean, the great composers all benefited from their sponsors and their patrons, you know, that paid for them. It's yes, they could. But, you know, don't forget the state is going to benefit. You know, this is not a one way street. The state is going to massively benefit from, you know, as I say, Korea, you know, getting 10.5 billion euro in 2023 just from their exports. Never mind their own thing. You know, there's room for us to do more. And by the way, that's just the financial gains. Like, think about the soft power. It has made, you know, South Korea's soft power huge around the world. And, you know, the same is true of, has been true of Ireland in the past and can be true of Ireland again. But, we need to be careful that we look after the creators and specifically creators.
Okay. Eleanor McAvoy, thank you very much for being with us as chairperson of the Irish Music Rights Organisation.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Welcome back. And having spoken there to Eleanor McAvoy, chairperson of the Irish Music Rights Organisation, our next guests are Dee Reddy and Dave Hanratty, who is standing in for John Cadell again this week. And the first thing I want to talk about is sort of related to what we spoke about there with Eleanor McAvoy. And something we discussed on the business news briefly last week, this idea that Netflix and Spotify might start broadcasting live gigs. I suspect, Dee, this would only be for the very big elite acts, wouldn't it? This would be your sort of your Taylor Swifts and your Dua Lipas and what have you.
Yeah, I mean, almost certainly they're probably only likely to take an act who would have that sort of international appeal, because anything like that is going to work at a kind of at scale model, as opposed to maybe presenting gigs in the way that some people might think they should be, as a means to enjoy culture in quite an intimate way. I'm not sure how I feel about this one, to be perfectly honest. Like, on one level, yeah, great that people might have a less expensive way to access an artist that they really like. But on another level, it feels like it takes the real heart out of a live performance. Like, even when people go to see a gig at a cinema, you're there with other people. It's there is a sort of collective experience that I think has been taken away by something like this.
What do you think, Dave?
It's just the evolution of entertainment in the age that we live in, really. I mean, Amazon have done this already to an extent, or they've certainly produced large-scale concerts and then put them up on the service after the fact. But it's kind of the overall move into live events in general, something that Netflix, I'm pretty sure, once upon a time said that they would never do, but never say never in this game. And whether it's Champions League football showing on Amazon, whether it's wrestling on Netflix, their massive deal that they signed with the WWE, showing NFL on Christmas, that kind of thing. It's the next wave of entertainment for people, and people really want their live thing to not leave the house. It's just right there in front of me. Perfect. I can watch a Kendrick Lamar gig. This is fine.
Yeah, but nothing beats being there. And look, I know that we watch an awful lot of our sport on television because we're not lucky enough or able to be at things like All-Ireland Finals or Ireland Rugby or Soccer Internationals or take it into European football and World Cups. And we're happy to watch stuff on television that we can't be live and present at. But a concert's different, isn't it? I mean, has there ever really been a concert on a screen that has come anywhere near, Dee, what it's like to be at it?
Probably not, Matt, because, you know, it's that thing of being in a moment in time with other people. I mean, the fact that they would potentially be streamed live so that at least everyone's kind of consuming them by and large at the same time is slightly better, but you really just the interaction between a performer and the crowd that's in front of them, it's quite a special thing, and it does feel like everyone's just being siloed off to have these individual experiences on their own, as opposed to in a kind of more communal way, which is really, really important to music, you know?
Although last Friday, Dave, when you were with us through the week trending, we were talking about Electric Picnic and RT's previous efforts to televise some of it, which weren't particularly successful and hasn't been repeated. And could you see the potential for something like Netflix deciding that Electric Picnic would be something that it would stream worldwide?
They'd probably rather get the rights to a Glastonbury, but obviously that's staying under lock and key with the BBC for the foreseeable, I would imagine, although the recent controversy and some heads rolling there might...
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
Yeah, there might be a few emails being sent around. It's a very good idea. Picnic would be great if they did it, but again, you're talking budget. I think they are going to stay international with the big fish. What I would say, sorry, just to add to the last point, is it's extremely rare that a televisual performance of a piece of music live can blow you away, but it can happen, whether it's Frank Ocean on Saturday Night Live, a very intimate performance. The first time I saw Nine Inch Nails doing Hurt live, I saw it on YouTube and it changed my opinion of the band completely. And even at the most recent Glastonbury, 1975, closing their show with About You, I went back and I watched that on YouTube the other day. I got chills.
Which brings us nicely to the 40th anniversary of Live Aid, which is this Sunday. Now, both of you are too young to remember it. You probably weren't even born when the time when it actually happened 40 years ago. I remember it because I would have been in college at the time, and I remember the Saturday watching what happened in Wembley and then Philadelphia and watching it. But it is fascinating now, Dee, to look at it as well, because for all of the fact that this was a charitable endeavour in designed to raise money for people in Ethiopia and Africa, what it also did was resuscitate the careers of many bands that were, I suppose, on the decline. And now some people are arguing that in some respects it set up the sort of the stadium rock era that followed.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was an interesting piece in The Telegraph this week where they went so far as to say how Live Aid ruined music forever. And the argument they were making was that it sort of had a chilling effect on people being interested in new artists rather than these people that had a easily recognizable back catalogue for the widest possible global audience, and that, you know, they were performing greatest hits packages as opposed to actually performing an album. I mean, I do think it's something that there is merit to that argument, and it's something that we've seen a move away from.
It is, sir, because I'm just thinking, like, for example, Oasis are a child of the 90s, as an example. Their stadium rock, that was not, they weren't blocked from coming forward on the basis of the acts of Live Aid in 1985 stymieing everyone else.
Well, it is a piece from the Telegraph, exactly. Matt, so I was going to caveat by saying there is
contrarian Telegraph, no way.
By saying that it also introduced these artists to a new, younger generation. And that is something that has really contributed in such a positive way, actually, I think, to the music landscape that we see today. And it's not often you can say such a sweeping statement in such positive terms about the music industry nowadays. But what it did was, you know, people used to exist, and I remember even in my youth, people existed much more in these sort of kind of pockets of genre, you know, where you might look like a punk and listen to punk music, or, you know, you might have a very specific curated style. And this sort of event actually brings a much wider array of artists. So you now have kids coming up whose musical influences come from such an incredible array of musicians, everything from old school rock to the early pop career of Madonna or what have you. And I actually think that it's a much more inclusive, and it's a lovely way for people to approach music.
There's so much apologizing though when it comes to Live Aid. There's so much self-cannibalism when it comes to it as well. I mean, I don't think I think Dee's right. It didn't invent nostalgia. Always going to have a comeback tour as an Oasis right now, no matter what, without it. But it is interesting to see where it sits in history. So what, July 13th, 1985. So I was 1 year and 1 day old, by the way, just to clarify.
So you don't remember it.
I don't remember, but I've seen so many documentaries and I've seen, you know, the terrible depiction of it in the terrible Bohemian Rhapsody film where it looks like he's playing to a PlayStation 2 crowd. It was just weird. But like,
but although it was a massive event for Queen.
It was huge. It was huge for so many people and it did do a lot of positive things, but it is in the annals now of this kind of poetic remembrance of everything being perfect and so on. Like the Telegraph thing is interesting because at first I was like, oh, look, yeah, typical headline, but it's a good headline and there's an interesting argument in there. I don't think it's completely true. What's interesting though is that years later they tried to kind of do it again with Live 8 in, I believe, 2005. And like, to me, the only thing I remember about that is the possibly apocryphal story of Pete Doherty allegedly knocking Johnny Burrell out backstage, which is not saying a lot for peace then, is it?
Okay. All right, let's move on. Let's get your picks of the week. Dee, what are you going for, please?
So my pick of the week this week is from a Derry band called Beauty Sleep. Really, really interesting duo. They're kind of described as radical alt-pop. This is called Big and Bad, and it's taken off their highly anticipated second album, which will be out later this year, called The Whole Damn Cake. And I have to say, I love that title. So this is Beauty Sleep with Big and Bad.
Very good, Dee. Is that anything like their first album?
Yeah, I mean, look, their sound is definitely, I think, a lot more polished and developed this time around, but it's definitely taking a lot of the same influences. And what I really like what they've done with this is, which you don't see that much anymore, they've released it as a double single.
Double A single. Side. Oh, that brings me back to my youth. A double A side.
I thought you'd like that, Matt. So you've not just got Big and Bad, but you've also got another track, Unfamiliar, that were released today from that album.
Okay, that's Beauty Sleep, which Dave was smiling along to there.
Double
as well.
A side is very Live Aid. I think it factors in perfectly.
It really is, isn't it?
What's your pick, Dave?
So with the caveat that I'm still very upset with hip-hop icon Pusha T for cancelling his Dublin show twice over. We're never going to see him here, unfortunately. He's amazing, though. Before he became a hip-hop icon in his own right and before he destroyed the credibility of Drake's career, he was in a group with his brother back in the 2000s. They were called Clips. His brother goes by the name of Malice, but then he found religion and he became No Malice, which I think is genius, by the way. Isn't that really clever? Fair play to him. The point is, after all of this, teasing, Clips are back. They're an active group again, having kind of initially resurfaced a few years ago. Fully fledged album coming this Friday. It's called Let God Sort Them Out, another great album title, and I'm very, very excited. There's a lot to live up to here, but here's the first single. The first single from the album is called Ace Trumpets, and I think it gives us a nice taste of what's to come.
Ballerinas doing pirouettes inside of my snow globe. Shopping sprees in Soho, you had to see it. Strippers shaking and watching the dough blow. Ace trumpets and rose molds. Yellow diamonds look like PP. Fly from DC on my private to Waikiki. 3P. This my son's and that's on repeat. Sins of the father, so I call you little Michis. It's easy. How could you and me be? Ever seen his peers can't compare, you just CC. Don't you know these clears in my ears only VVs? Play musical chairs, Fred Astaire through these GTs. Too much wear and tear on your, you couldn't please me. White glove service with the brick, I am Luigi. Gucci, sold ecstasy and disappeared. I am Houdini. Look at them, him and him, still waiting on Yeezy. I hope you got your squeegees. Had your interviews, I just kiki, life's peachy, ASAP.
So is that teaser from Clips grabbing you, Dave, is it?
It is, to the point that I accidentally hit the microphone on the way in there, so I do apologise, that's how excited I am. And the production of Pharrell Williams worries me, though. I think he's kind of sanded all the edges off in his own career.
Make it too poppy, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, this shouldn't be that, and I hope it won't be, but I'm very excited. Like, Pusha T, I listen to him read the phone book, so I'm in on Friday. Clips is name of the group for anyone who is unfamiliar.
And the album coming on Friday, Let God Sort Him Out, which you're right, that is a great album name. Even John Cadell, if he was here, I think might actually agree that that's a good one. What did you make, Dee, of Apple's 10-year anniversary and the most streamed music on that particular platform and Ed Sheeran coming out on top?
Yeah, I just don't think it's a huge surprise looking at the top 10. But I mean, Ed Sheeran's in it twice. You've got Post Malone in it twice, Drake in it twice. And then you've also got a bit of Billie Eilish, Chris Brown, The Weeknd. It just, in some ways, I kind of wonder, was it silly of them to release it? Because all it does is just show the intense homogenization of music that they have managed to, alongside other companies, bring about.
About that. It's all about the downloads. It's all about the Benjamins.
100%, yeah. And like, commercial artists are always going to rule the roost on this.
I need a clip of you saying that.
Sorry, can I just say, I think like the big takeaway for me here is that the
influenced by your pick of the week there.
Well, in fairness, I'll take half the credit. The biggest takeaway here for me is that the oldest song in the list is Bohemian Rhapsody from 1975. And that's it. Nothing beyond that, or before that, I should say.
Or it's a bit like music only started 10 years ago because Apple started streaming.
See, this is a problem as well with other entertainment outlets, because Netflix, if you go on there, there's so little films on there from before, I think it's 85, 80, 70, whatever. Like, they don't have classics. They don't skew to that. And fair enough, you're talking to a generation, et cetera, et cetera. But like, it's not the erasure of classic music, but it's certainly not the promotion of it. And I think that is a bit of a problem.
Okay, I see then the likes of Taylor Swift only came in way, way down the list. First entry at 57 with Cruel Summer. But I suppose, Dee, that's because sometimes the bigger artists have so many tracks that the listens sort of get spread amongst them.
Yeah, and I think as well, I mean, what's interesting about Apple, I suppose, is they have kind of almost like similar to radio programming built baked into their offering. So, you know, you can go on and you can listen to a show presented by, I think Elton John did one at one stage, for example. So you do get a lot of artists that are going to make the list repeatedly, like the Ed Sheerans of this world, but it's not necessarily, I think, as reflective as Spotify might be of the stuff that the Uber fans are listening to on repeat.
Okay, we got to leave it there. We're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you very much, Dee Reddy and Dave Hanratty, for being with us.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.